Derek. Yeah, it's a pity we're pressed for time, because when we did the practice run, I went too long anyway, and I got told to shorten it. So hopefully I'll achieve that, and I'll do it by not necessarily talking to all the points as we go along. With a bit of luck, that'll leave you with some questions as well. And I spent some time in the last little while thinking about operational risk and doing some work in the area, and it did cross my mind that the question of why is it hard is an important one. And it's not just because I have trouble with it. I think there's a bit more to it than that. At least, yeah, I certainly hope so. Otherwise, this is going to be kind of boring. But I think it's actually a useful question to ask. And it's not only because it's a new area, although that's certainly part of it. So to sort of set the context, let's sort of address what the animal we're looking at is. And I think it's now fairly well established that the basic definition of operational risk given by out of Basel II for banks, and it's also being used for Solvency II in Europe, and from our point of view, APRA used the same definition, so it must be correct, is that operational risk is the risk of a loss resulting from inadequate or failed processes, people or systems, which does give you a fair amount of scope. And if that's not good enough, we toss in external events as well. Now, I make a couple of observations about that. One is the breadth of the scope that's sitting in operational risk, right? There's all sorts of things that can happen if you're going to mess up your processes, if you're going to mess up with your people, you're going to mess up your systems. And Basel II and APRA have a hierarchy of things you can go down. There's various business lines and various product lines. It goes down quite deeply. So it's a very broad exercise, is the point I want to take away from that. And there's nothing there that really relates, certainly so far, to banking, let alone financial services. It's generic as well. And needless to say, it's not all-inclusive, because you can't ever claim to have a full definition. But it excludes things like reputational risk and systemic risks and so on. And I think that's partly because people aren't comfortable they can even have a cut at estimating them, but also because you can't do everything all the time. There's a certain point where, for some risks, you just go, bad luck. Okay, we can't measure everything all the time. So that's the definition, which gives us, as I say, lots of scope. And I always like to ask the question when you're doing these things of, in some form or other, do we care? I mean, is this important? I mean, in some sense, the argument could be it's not that important. It's only a new invention. It only came out of Basel II. It's 5 or 6 years old. We survived quite happily without it beforehand. So maybe, maybe not. First risk here is, this is a bad starting point. A best estimate of nil, right, for things that you know are going to go wrong, not good. You're guaranteed you're on it. But, you know, if you stop and think about it, for a lot of things that we don't understand and we can't quantify, we put in a nil estimate. I don't know what it is, so I'll put nothing in there. So, yes, you might laugh, but this is a real issue. A couple of things have happened recently. That was a fairly big event, and it's not alone. Unit pricing errors. Now, unit pricing errors are quite neat, not only because I have an interest in them, but they're also an example of a type of risk that continually recurs. We're always seeing unit pricing errors, either in this country or overseas, and the reality is they're going to continue to occur. So these things aren't necessarily one-off. They come in the leaping or the creeping category. The leaping category being a spike and it happens and it's a big event, like Société Générale, at least from their point of view. We hope it's only a one-off event. Or they're sort of creepers. There's lots of them and they just accumulate. All right. HIH, you could put in this category from an Australian point of view. That was a significant glitch, as they say. I've seen some work in the US. This is from 2003, but the argument was restricted to financial institutions over 100 events worth more than $100 million a pop. This was reported stuff. All right. And there's a distinction between what happens and what's reported. So this is probably the tip of your iceberg, and it's not like there aren't events happening in the US as well. And the last bit's dot, 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 but you know, this is a case where you go, use your imagination here. Anti-money laundering. Okay, big events around the world in anti-money laundering, they're operational risk. Natural catastrophes, okay, Katrina and so on. Outworkings of those, operational risks. So it's very broad, and I think it's pretty clear that the answer is, yes, we do care, and this view here, which could be translated to won't happen in my backyard, is probably fallacious. So it's time for the ostriches to take their head out of the sand. It's an actuarial presentation, so you have to have some numbers. So really all I've done here is, for a couple of scenarios, one minus the probability of no events. The really interesting bit is you get down to here. I've got a world of 20 entities, and I've got a probability of a major event of 1 in 10. I'm not going to define major, but you can think of this as entity threatening, let's say, in some form. 5 years, is it going to happen? No, it's a pretty fair chance. So from a helicopter point of view, this stuff is going to happen. So that means you have to have a change of paradigm from a point of view of managing it, from maybe I can prevent it happening to when something bad goes wrong, what do I do? Now from a governance point of view and an attitudinal point of view, that's a really important shift, because you've already accepted that bad things are going to happen. The job then is how to minimise it, how to catch it quickly, and how to deal with it. But it's not about, we will make sure it won't happen again. So if you're going to take the politician route and say, oh yes, it's happened somewhere else in the industry, we must be so good that we won't have one of these events, right? Time to go and think again, because that just isn't going to happen. Especially if you take any sort of regulatory perspective, helicopter view, you know it's going to happen. So you're into control and management of it. So serious from that point of view as well. Now, I want to leave you with the thought that in some senses, operational risk is intrinsically different than a bunch of other risks that we face. And some of it I've already alluded to in the sense of the breadth of it, but there are some other reasons why it's intrinsically different as well. Before I make some comments there, I want to make the observation that I think for those of us who are interested in enterprise risk management as opposed to operational risk, that a lot of the issues that arise in operational risk are the same issues that are arising in enterprise risk management. So if we understand or get a view on what's happening and how to manage things in the op risk environment, we have a natural springboard into the ERM environment. All right? And I think those things will come through in terms of these comments. Firstly, it's not new. All right? The term's new and the idea of applying a holistic approach to it's new, but most of the things in operational risk are not new. We're talking about fraud. We're talking about IT failures. We're talking about business continuity plans. We're talking about HR things that don't work. None of these are new. Okay, so don't go away with the view that operational risk is suddenly something magic that's appeared. What has happened is we're taking a bunch of disparate things, right, in terms of structure, in terms of behaviour, and we're now trying to put a structure over them. From an insurance point of view, we're trying to manage a portfolio that's made up of heterogeneous risks, right? In contrast to the traditional view of insurance, where we're trying to manage a portfolio of homogeneous risks. That's a fundamental difference that we need to take into account in terms of how we think and how we go about doing it. It probably tells us automatically that this is an order of magnitude more complicated. Okay? But it's not all new. It's unavoidable. If you're in business, right, particularly in the financial services, you are in business to manage some sort of risk, be it insurance or investment or whatever. As soon as you're doing that, you have the risk that you'll mess it up. So it's unavoidable. It's part of the game. You can't choose to avoid this risk. So that's the bad news. It's entity specific. Okay? Entities have different cultures, they have different people, they have different processes. If you're looking at changes or issues that come out of people, processes and systems, it's going to be entity specific. There'll be common themes and common areas for error, but it's driven by the entity. So that tells you that taking experience from other entities is an exercise that's fraught with danger. Okay, because they have to be like you in order to make it comparable. It's a bit like walking down the street if you're doing a pricing exercise and you walk down the street and you get the premium car for the company down the road and go, that'll do me. All right, we know that's not usually a good plan. Well, same sort of thing when you're starting to pick up data. Okay, so you need to understand that. The data's not independent, which is picking up on the same theme I had beforehand, but events that happened 5 years ago may just not be relevant now. Often when we look at data, there's this implied assumption of stationarity of data. But what happened 5 years ago was in a different environment, a different control environment, or a different organisation. That may not be relevant to you now. So the data's not independent over time or, as I said beforehand, over entities. So data's going to be a problem. Breadth and the disparity of the aspects I've covered already. One of the things that doesn't come out often in the sort of stuff we look at is the fundamental role that the culture of an entity plays. When you're looking at an entity and you're looking at issues arising, reporting of near misses and all that stuff, you have to have a culture which encourages people to put their hand up early. Because you don't know there's a problem, it's really hard to fix it. Okay, so entity culture is really important here. Right, and there are a few classic examples. Anybody here from NAB? Right, remember 2004? Okay, the rogue trading issue? Not a big deal from a cost point of view, really, in relative terms. The absolutely striking thing was that everybody who investigated, APRA and the independent auditors, all said this is a cultural problem, from the top to the bottom. Right, and, you know, it was sort of entity threatening, but only in the context of knock-on effects. So culture's key to this stuff. And as I sort of alluded to beforehand, your residual risk profile evolves over time. You're only interested in residual risk here, just like you are with any other sort of risk. So at that point, it can start being counterintuitive because it's the residual bit you're looking at. But as you change your control environment, you change your risk profile environment. So it's a moving feast. So I think those are some of the reasons why this is a little bit of a different animal than the sort of stuff we as actuaries like to look at. It's not like mortality moves a little bit, but it's slow and predictable, okay, relatively. Now, in terms of approaching this, I have a sort of a governance in the broadest term of the word approach, and this is not to do with risk management really, but it applies to it as well. And the way it works is you have a number of levels of people who are involved, so from the top to the bottom. So I'm going from effectively going to go, I'll come back to that in a second, but central to this is the culture and the people that you have in the organisation. You're only as good as your people, you're only as good as your culture. So it's going to be in the centre of a picture. In order to go anywhere, you need some policy. Okay, so in this context, set by the board or whoever's in charge. God, if you prefer. Once you've got an idea of where you would like to go, this is the easy bit, by the way, you go and do it. You implement it. It happens at a lower level, and that's where your processes and your systems and all that good stuff reside. So far, I've got a project, and the project would have one arrow on this line, from policy toward implementation. All right, this will start looking very familiar, I hope, to people soon. All right, however, I think there are two arrows that need to be here. Once you've decided what you do, you then go and see if you can do it, and sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. So there's a feedback loop. But even once I finish the implementation, I do actually have to ask the question of, did it work? Ongoing process. Is this looking familiar yet? Right? And that's where all the accountability and the sign-offs and, you know, audit and compliance and all that stuff. So for the purpose of this discussion, risk management's on top, internal audit and compliance, they're on the bottom. And on the right. Each of these steps needs to talk to each other as well because it's a moving feast. So now I've got a paradigm for managing a process. It comes out of the analytic cycle from the actuarial control and practice paradigm. Identify, solve, monitor, right? It's a cycle. Very generally applicable. How does this work in a operational risk management point of view? Well, with a bit of luck, we start at the beginning again, culture and people. What do I then do? Well, better define my risk appetite, because I can't manage risk unless I know what appetite I've got for it. So here's my policy and how I'm going to manage it. Usually the place we go then is you build capital models, right? Either be it for regulatory capital or economic capital. And we all love building models. Point I want to make about building a model is it's a passive exercise in the sense that what you're doing is measurement. Right? It gives you an answer. Now you know where you are. It doesn't tell you necessarily what you're going to do. So it's passive and it's measure. That's not the word that's on the right-hand side of the title, which is management. They're different things. I put that into place with my double arrows and I get business judgment. Because sometimes the models are wrong. And we need to know that before we go further ahead. So there's an interaction that's happening here, which regulators and co, when they're talking about Basel II and stuff and saying, what's the output from your model? Is that what's going into the accounts? Need to think about. From the point of view of the monitoring, what I've put in here is behaviour and awareness, because what you're really interested in is prevention. Okay, you'd much rather not use the capital up, so you want prevention. How do you get prevention? Well, you focus on the behaviour and the awareness of the people. Okay, how do I do that? Well, I better have some allocation and ownership. Otherwise, how do I measure it and how do I control it? So, what's happening here is I compute the grand total model, which goes off to the regulator, and it goes, it's in the accounts, forget about it. I also have, over here, an allocation model of some form. Whatever capital I've worked out for whatever purpose, I'm going to give a responsibility out for it. There's an allocation model here that's just as important as the capital model. And, of course, across the bottom, I've got what happens to my residual risk and my residual changes. These things all work in sync. Whichever one is the weakest link will break the whole process. And my point to actuaries is, don't get stuck over here. There's more to it than that. Now, so far, I've been talking a bit about models and that sort of stuff. That has an underlying presumption behind it, which actuaries generally fall into. This presumes that I can build a model. This presumes that what I'm looking at is, in this context, what I'll call, with apologies to Donald Rumsfeld, a known risk. It has two key characteristics. I know what it is, and I can quantify it and I can measure it. All right? They're presumptions. Not all risks are in that category. Okay? If they're not in that category, it doesn't mean they're not going to happen. It just means one of those presumptions failed. So I've got two other types of risks we need to think about. What I've called is an unknown risk. By this I mean, you know it's there, but you can't quantify it. That reputational risk. It's a bit tough to quantify, but you know it's there. All right. So you can't manage it directly financially. Doesn't mean you can't manage it, by the way, from the actuary's point of view. It means you can't do it using your standard sort of textbook paradigms. Zero is a bad estimate, potentially, still. Last and not least, we've got these things called unknowable risks. Okay? Don't know what they are. If we did know, they'd be one of the prior two categories. And if this category is empty, then we're all a lot closer to God than we'd like to think. So, you know, there's this, the black swans are sitting in here, in particular. Right? And again, you know at some point they're going to happen, at either corporate level or the individual level. So, can't identify it, can't quantify it, so I've got a problem. Doesn't mean I can't solve it, but I need to be aware of this. So, again, don't get lost up here. Bigger game than that. Okay, for a couple of comments around why is op risk hard, if you like, in particular. Well, I've alluded to this already, data. So we have internal, the idea is you have internal data because you look back at your own history and you've recorded it, and there's a whole raft of questions that sit around that. Did you record everything? Did you, what thresholds did you apply? Is it being consistently recorded and categorised? Because op risk is so broad, you have to categorise events. So it's a categorisation issue. Have you done it consistently over years? The answer is almost certainly no. What do you do about having consistency within your data from over time? Inflation, scaling perhaps, because your entity might have changed size. So it's not relevant just to pick the headline numbers up. So there's a whole raft of issues sitting around internal data in terms of quality and quantity. So it's a tough problem before you start. And because this is mostly concerned with extreme events, because it's the really big stuff you care about, you know, entity-ending type events, of course, if your entity's still going, you probably haven't got any entity-ending events because you're still there. So you've got a bias in the data as well, which you need to address. At least you need to recognise that it's there. External data, well, the theory is if you haven't got enough internal data, get somebody else's. All right? Well, that's fine, except that you have all the issues you had beforehand, and you have to look at it and go, well, just because this entity fell over for this reason, you know, could that happen to me? And the answer might be yes, and it might be no. This entity's half the size I am or twice the size I am by some measure, yet to be determined. How do I translate its $100 million loss across to me? Do I divide by size? There's a academic debate going on about how to do... This is the question of scaling from one entity to another. There's an academic debate going on about how you do it. And, you know, get three academics in a room. It's a bit like actuaries. Three academics, four opinions. Okay? We don't know is the answer. There is some empirical evidence out there, but that's about it. So I've got relevance, I've got scaling. Different people have different thresholds for what they report. So I suddenly got a raft of different tales of distributions all being put together and presented as the final amount of data. It's biased. So I need to be careful about that. And then we have scenarios, which is, well, it hasn't happened yet, but we'll think about what might happen if it does. Expert opinion. There's nothing wrong with doing this, except this is tough stuff as well. I'd suggest to you that from a behavioural finance point of view, people aren't bad at estimating things at a 1 in 25 type frequency, or maybe up to 1 in 50. It's sort of in living experience. You've got a feel for it. How many people genuinely think they can draw the distinction between a 1 in 500 event and a 1 in 1,000 or a 1 in 10,000 event? Well, I'm not putting my hand up. Right? It just doesn't happen very often. Right? But we're doing Basel II, we're looking at 1 in 1,000 events, 99.9%. We're out in extreme tails of distribution. So, you know, reliability of scenarios for a whole distribution, open to question. And the last and not least, external extreme events, the outliers. Well, tradition is you toss outliers out because they bias the results. So that's what we're after, is the outliers. So got to be really careful. Different perspective. So data's a problem. Modelling, right? This is the toys that we like to play with. First point, models don't manage risks. They just measure it. Other people manage risks. So don't get too tied up in it. There are a raft of theoretical issues floating around. How do you go about the process of establishing or not establishing independence between two of my heterogeneous piles of risk? Don't know. Correlation coefficients are clearly not enough. You need more than that, because the old saying is, as life gets bad, correlations tend to go to plus or minus one. They move. If you're looking at extreme events, they're going to move. So there's certainly a higher order sitting here than standard correlations. Don't forget, model results are imprecise. There's model noise. Right? If anybody's done modelling of numbers, you look at MLE results. MLE results have a variance in them, okay? Because they're estimates. You go out to the extreme of a log normal distribution, which is sort of typical for this, you're at a 99.9th percentile, and you look at the difference in the result you get using your best, your MLE estimate, your best estimate, and add a couple of standard deviations, one will do, and subtract a standard deviation, so you get the right distribution, which is not really extreme, you'll move the answer by 50%. Right? So at the extremes, be very, very wary of the numbers that are coming out. So it raises a whole raft of issues about level of confidence in the numbers you've got from the model, which needs to be addressed. And that's not part of the 99.9% underlying requirement. This is sort of compound conservatism that you have to manage. How do we do aggregations and dependencies? Well, the honest answer is with difficulty. Okay, but, you know, again, assume zero correlations and add everything up like the regulators do. Not a good answer. Maybe not even a good approximation, but need to work on it. Confidence intervals for results I've talked about. A pet topic of mine, which is application risk. The world's made up of about 5% theory, that is 5% of what you should do. And the other 95% is, did you do it? All right. Most operational risks come about because of application risk. Unit pricing, right? It's not because people didn't know what they should do, generally. But everybody knows that. This presentation earlier on said it's pretty simple, just divide assets by units. So they knew what they should have done. The problem is they didn't actually do it. Okay, that's application risk. It's 95% of the world is there. And it applies to models and model management and, you know, is it consistent with what we did last year and can I reproduce the results anyway, you know, from year to year, etc. And I want to make a couple of comments about the risk of intuition, because we like to think we have good intuition. So here's an example that might, hopefully it's nice and simple, that might just make you sit up. So this is because I was playing one day, so that's why the numbers are a bit funny. I've got some loss data, doesn't matter where it comes from, and my expected loss is 4.5 million, right? Don't ask me where that came from, it just did. And I couldn't be bothered going back and making it a nice round number. It doesn't matter. And I know that the 75th percentile of my losses is 8.2 million. All right? So now I've got enough data here to start doing some modelling. I've got two data points, if you like. So I wouldn't necessarily expect it to be too accurate, but there you go. And what happens? Well, generally when people think about this from an intuitive point of view, they have two key things. Firstly, you tend to think linearly. Small changes in inputs will make small changes in outputs, and vice versa. And normally, a lot of intuition is based around the traditional normal distribution. Okay, that's where we get a lot of it from. And in some parts of the world, it's the only distribution that exists, including Oprisk and VAR and things like that. So let's have a look at this. This is a new toy. There you go. Here's a normal distribution. Standard sort of characteristics. And 4.5 comes out to 8.2 or whatever it was. And as I move out here, I get some. I can measure it out in terms of standard deviations. We all know about this. So by the time I get the three standard deviations out, I'm at the 99.9th percentile. I don't know where it went. It's probably just over here somewhere. Okay, there it is there. The label disappeared. Normal distribution. Everybody comfortable with that? Think about three standard deviations. I'm in the extreme tail of what's happening for this distribution. However, I'm rather clever, and I know that bad distribution. So what I'll do is I'll say, well, let's do the log normal distribution instead. I've got two data points, so I'll match my log normal at the 50th and the 75th percentile. So I'll get the same answer for those two. So now I've got a comparison. And now let's work my way out for the 90th and the 95th, the 99th, etc. The 99.9th percentile is about where Derek's head is. Okay, it's about 9 standard deviations out. It's a long way. Okay, long-tailed distribution. So, got those two pictures in mind. So what does this do? Well, if my objective on this process is to, let's say, hold the 99.9th percentile, and I've made the mistake of using the log normal distribution. The normal distribution. So under the normal distribution, I have to hold enough capital to hit the 99.9th percentile. So here it is. I've got to hold $22 million. Everybody's happy. Go off to management, report it, no problem. Drawback is that really it's a log normal distribution. So if I did the log normal part of it properly, 72. Ratio, by the way, is 3 1/3. It's a big ratio. So if I've used the normal distribution and reported it at the 99.9th, and it's actually a log normal distribution, I've actually, roughly, computed only the 95th percentile. Wrong answer. Wrong level of confidence. From a management point of view, you might live with these sorts of numbers as ratios, but you're really not going to be happy with this. So, risk of intuition. My intuition about normal distribution, not good. So, be careful. In a lot of the work that we've done, we've seen that conservatism in of itself is an issue. And this is one of the places where actuaries can really add a lot to this, because actuaries tend, or should tend nowadays, to think in the context of best estimate plus explicit margins. And the absolute two key words here are best estimate on the one hand, and the other key word is explicit. Because if you have explicit margins, you can then have a debate about how big they are because you've quantified them. So you can debate whether it's two measures of deviation, be they standard deviations or three or one or whatever it turns out to be. If on the other hand, like a lot of people, you don't do that and you go, we'll just make it conservative. When someone comes along and says, how conservative? All you can go is, it is. Trust me. I made a conservative assumption. Fundamental shift. And going to organisations who aren't used to it, and this is very scary for them. It's very hard to do. Anybody who was around in the 90s when Moz came in will understand the issue. Okay, it's a serious issue. And the other point is, a lot of this stuff tends to focus on the inputs. We'll put conservative inputs into a process, and we'll assume the output's going to be conservative. We might do more than that. We might know it's going to be because it behaves itself well. But the issue for models and that stuff isn't how conservative are your inputs. That's not the question. The question is, how conservative are your outputs? So you need to recognise that conservative inputs generate conservative outputs, but the question, even if I answer the question here about how conservative are these, I still haven't answered the question here. And this is the place where I care about it. Okay, so, you know, Moz has a problem because Moz is here for those. Okay, role of business judgment, I talked about that beforehand. Just because the number comes out of the model doesn't mean it's right. It just means it gives you some indication about what to do. So it's important. And noise in the tail of distributions, I alluded to as well. Okay, but if you're out in the tails, it's going to be a very noisy process. So we're still talking about numbers. From a management point of view, come back to the key point. This is all about culture. It's about whether people report things, whether they hide it or not, whether they tell you early or not, you know, whether they miscategorise it or not, all those sorts of things. Having said that, we're all in business to do things, take new risks that we understand, and all those. So you can't stifle the business. We're here to protect it, but fundamentally, if the business doesn't work, no amount of protection is going to get you there. So you've got to be balanced about it. And I think the test from a management point of view is not so much how many risks you've avoided. I mean, you want to avoid as many as you can, but it more is when a risk event does happen, how do you manage it? Right? Different paradigm. This comes from, we know bad things are going to happen, how do we minimise the impact? Not, do we prevent them happening forever? Just make the observation that risk avoidance and risk management are quite different things. And if you read quite a lot of the literature around operational risk, you will find statements that go along the lines of, the risk manager's job is to ensure risk events, you know, don't happen. Right? They're as simple as that. It's about as good as the politician saying, we will ensure no more general insurance or life insurance companies fail in our jurisdiction ever. Right? Risk avoidance is about guarantees, right? And risk management is about minimising and understanding the damage. But conceptually, fundamentally different. So actuaries have a role in terms of education here, because if something does go wrong, and if we've sort of agreed it will, it doesn't mean your risk management process has failed. What it means is one of the outliers that you were worried about has come home to roost. Well, sometimes the answer is bad luck and get on with it. You might review your processes so you pick that one off again, but something else will be out there. So a bad event coming along does not of itself mean the process has failed. It might mean they're inadequate, but that's a different thing. And you don't go out and shoot people and fire people as a consequence. If you do, they won't talk to you ever again, which means your culture's shot. So one of the things that Société Générale did, and I don't know the inside story, but one day after it came out, two senior risk managers were fired. Think about it. And the other point is you need to understand the causes and not the symptoms. Okay? Big symptoms of small diseases are, you know, in the extreme event category, really extreme. Little symptoms of big diseases, they're what you need to worry about. So size of loss in of itself isn't necessarily the only thing you need to worry about. It's why is it there? And that's sober reflection and analysis. It's not, I got it on the risk register and I got rid of it in 2 weeks. It's a different question. Right? Again, actuaries ought to be able to do that sort of thing. Stand back and analyse and understand. And sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not. Just want to come back a little bit to the unquantifiable risks. Okay, so this is my unknowable risks. Can't do anything about them. Haven't got any data. So what do I do? Again, zero is a bad estimate. Well, I can certainly talk about the process I would use if something like that came along. So I can work on the attitude of people, and I can work on scenarios. Okay? Serious workshops and say, if this happened, what will we do? How will we manage it? Lots of stuff coming out in all sorts of literature, by the way, around consequences of whether things under Katrina did or didn't work. Learnings to be taken away from it. So I can do that. That's a theoretical point of view, by the way. I can also go and practice, right? I can go and practice my business continuity plan or my IT failure plan or whatever it turns out, real-life practices. And then I find where the weakest link in my process is. And it might be something really simple like I didn't have the mobile phone number of the person in the business who I needed to contact. The only phone number I had was their daytime work number. And when the event happened on the weekend, I couldn't get in touch with them. Heard of examples like that. So it's the weakest link in the process. It's not the most interesting one, generally, because we focus on it. It's the weakest one. The only way you find that's practice. And everybody's going to go, oh yeah, that's fine. So here are some examples. Business continuity plans coming from Katrina. Yeah, people are starting to get serious about doing that. Pandemics. APRA put out work in Australia saying go and develop a pandemic plan and practice it. Some have, some haven't done the plan. Some have, some haven't practiced it. But if you really want to bring this home, when was the last time, A, that you had a practice fire drill in your building? And, more of the point, when was the last time you took it seriously? Right? Well, here's the weakest link. If it happens, it's an extreme event, but if you don't know where to go, you're going to be very upset. It's culture. That's what that's about. Right? And understanding the consequences, and just because it's got a small probability of happening, when it does, it's a doozy. Okay, so we certainly can start addressing these in terms of attitude and scenarios and backup plans and so on. And as actuaries, we need to be pursuing this. Just because we can't quantify it doesn't mean we put it in the too hard basket. A couple of focuses that APRA has at the moment, across the industries, banking, insurance and so on, all of which are operational risk. Right? Fairly broad list. I suspect not restricted to APRA at all. And a couple of concluding comments. From an actuarial point of view, this ought to be, actuaries ought to be leading this stuff. Right? We ought to be out there at the head of the operational risk quantification and analysis band. And the reality is we're not. So I'll offer you, let you go away and think about that. But it's new. New is interesting. New is also greenfields and relatively accessible. Right? So small contributions in that area can make a big difference. I think actuaries risk getting lost in the modelling. Back on that triangular picture in the bottom left-hand corner, there's the rest of the game to go and play. So get your heads up above the parapet. The keys, in my view, on this stuff are getting and understanding the data before you start modelling, and once you've done the modelling, interpreting the results in a business context. You will notice that this keys does not include building models. And that's deliberate. Lots of people can build models. It's what you put in them and what you do with the answers that's the key bit. That's where we as a profession really have an opportunity. Other people can build models at least as well as we can. So in summary, it's an opportunity. Be aware of the data limitations. Be aware of the model limitations. And what you're after is active risk management. You really want prevention. All right? Don't want cure, I want prevention. In this one application, that is what I really want is a good culture. I don't want more capital. Capital is curative. Buys you time, that's all, and it will run out. Prevention, culture, will lead this way. So it's about thinking ahead, doing the preventative stuff, in some sense doing the non-actuarial stuff around this. So that's all. I hope that was of some use. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jules. A round of applause, perhaps, for Jules at this juncture. I'm sure you'll get another opportunity. So, as I say, thanks a lot for that, Jules. It's a gigantic landscape in a way, and I'm sure you've only touched on a lot of the points, and would actually welcome an opportunity to speak at greater length at some time. We have about 20 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, left in our session now. I'm hoping people have some questions, so I'm throwing open the floor. I'll provide the microphone, and I hope we can have a roving microphone in this session. So any takers to lead us off? Anyone with questions or queries? Yes, can you state your name, by the way, and before the question?
Thank you for President General. One of the things, thanks for the presentation. One of the things I think covered very well is I think actuaries are probably pretty good on the model side, as you say, about trying to put distributions and all that. But at the end of the day, getting your probabilities of an event happening and how much it's going to cost you is only one side of it. The other is, what the hell do you do about it? In most extents, I'd say actuaries aren't particularly good in devising programs around operational risk about how to minimise that operational risk, not so much get rid of it, and then actually put a cost about that program to minimise the risk and then put that in context of the company. So it's one great thing if you're a AMP, Commonwealth Bank or whatever, say, look, we're worried about this risk. Someone goes around, puts a program, it's going to cost $50 million to implement it, and they say it's great. If you're a very small company, $50 million, just no way. And so then you need to think about, okay, what things can I put together which aren't going to cost very much, which do obviously leave a lot of residual risk that the company's saying, well, I'm prepared to accept that risk because I really don't have the money to do it. And I think that's the issue is you need to bring a lot of outside people in to start thinking about ways of actually fixing or minimising those risks and putting a cost around it. I don't know if you've got comments around that.
I would agree with that, and I think that it all comes back to the culture. And two ways of looking at this. One is you want to be actuaries, you want to quantify everything. The other way of looking at it is a whole bunch of qualitative issues that are floating around as well. And they sit down in culture and they sit down in processes. And you need two of them to work together. You're absolutely right. The other observation I'd make is that if you have a bunch of people who are working for you and they really understand what you're trying to do and where you're trying to go, then you end up with everybody being a risk manager. Right? So the trick, again, it comes back to culture and people. If you've got good people, they'll make bad processes and bad systems adequate. If you've got bad people, the world's best systems and the world's best processes are still going to fall over. So, yeah, I absolutely agree that this is actually not about the modelling in a sense. The modelling's a necessary tool. It's a necessary condition for success. It's a necessary tool, but the sufficient condition in the mathematical sense is the people and the culture. And that has to start from the top of the organisation. And it has not only has to start from there, it has to be seen to be starting from there as well. So perception is just as important. And the test of those things is going to be, you know, when something either may go wrong or does go wrong, you know, does the person who did the initial reporting get a reward or do they get shot? Whether you have an open culture or a closed culture. And that's where the tests come from. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Jenny Sparks. Firstly, I'd say I think the model's come a long way down the process. We're still very much at the point of saying, what are the risks? And then how do you manage them? And when you say, what are the risks? A lot of people just give blank stares, so it's, okay, what's keeping you awake at night, which is a very simple way to say it, but I found it very effective. Second observation on the entity-specific, yes, it's definitely entity-specific, but again, when you're identifying your risks, not necessarily quantifying them, but identifying it, helps a lot to look out at whatever other people identified as their risks, particularly if you say, well, we're an insurance company, and there's a lot of other insurance companies out there that have done a lot of work on operational risk. And the third observation, fire drills. You're absolutely right, Jules. We have earthquake drills constantly because we have a lot of earthquakes in Japan. Well, when there's going to be an earthquake drill, the secretary's up on the top floor, which is where I am, says executive management can't be bothered by earthquake drills. So we'll shut your doors and we'll let you know when it's all finished.
Does that translate to senior management don't get bothered by earthquakes either because they've got slightly higher status in some form? I think you're absolutely right. One of the dangers that we have as actuaries is before we start solving a problem, we like to understand all the parameters around it. And in this context for op risk, it's a bit like we want to understand all the risks. Well, you're not going to do it. Because if you can understand all the risks and there aren't any more out there, and I don't believe that's the case. So what we have to do is we have to get as many as you reasonably can, right? Which by whatever means, and you're right, looking at other organisations is a great way to do it. You go and get some of the publicly available databases and you look through them about all the events that are reported, recognising that the amounts might not matter and all that stuff, but you basically look through them for ideas. And then you take those ideas back to your organisation and you start going into workshops and developing scenarios. You know, could this happen? No. Well, it did happen to the bloke down the road, so let's reconvene and, you know, could this happen? All you're after is populating a database in a conceptual sense that's got enough in it so you can work with it. It will always be a work in progress. We will never get to the end of it. So this desire that we tend to have as actuaries to sort of get the answer, we need to change away from that. As long as you've got something that we understand and that we allow to move forward, you can always get a better estimate. Right? Even if you start off from a really bad one. Right? And really, really bad ones are zero. So it's not hard to get away from zero. Stick away $50 million or something, or 0.5% of funds under management, or something. Right? That's a better estimate than zero. And then move on from there. And I think there's an awful lot of this stuff that's absolutely generic. And that means there ought to be plenty of scope for industry-wide discussions without giving away any trade secrets. I mean, fraud's generic. Anti-money laundering is generic. If you want to get scared about anti-money laundering, by the way, go and read the joint forum paper about it from 2004 and you'll realise that anti-money laundering is big and they're really clever. All right? Serious operational risk.
Peter Barnes. I've got 2 points. So when we try and do our operational risk, we've got to estimate 4 points on each particular risk. The 10% probability, the 50% probability, or the amount involved, the 90% and the maximum, which gives us a lot of heartache trying to work out how far it's going to be when the maximum possible risk or amount which it'll cost if in any particular risk comes to fruition, or the one that we're thinking about in particular. So these models are really very difficult to get right and, as you say, cover every risk. On your last slide here in the summary, the active risk management, I'd put a third dot point under culture and capital, well, a third one under capital, and that is response. In other words, the response of the management when something does go wrong. And as you were saying, first thing that the French bank did is to fire their two people. So when it happens again, no one's going to put their hands up.
You can't even analyse what happened.
Well, and they won't be able to analyse it because everybody's gone. They won't talk to them. So it's the response of management and getting into their heads. In fact, operational events, risk events will occur, and it's not a failure. But it's how do we go about learning from it? How do we go about encouraging the people to keep looking, to keep thinking, to be a risk manager?
I think you're absolutely right. Activity implies that you go and do something. So testing and practicing and response absolutely should be there. I agree with that. And I think, you know, it's worthwhile thinking about it from the point of view of, if we have a risk appetite that says we want a 99% level of security about whatever it turns out to be, that means there's a 1% chance it's going to fail. If that 1% happens next year, you know, what's the reaction? How do you educate people so they understand that was unlikely, but, you know, bad things happen? So there's a real education process from a statistical point of view that sits around you. 100 doesn't mean it's going to happen in the 100th year from now, although that's what we'd like, or further.
Thanks very much, Jules. I'm kind of interested in a banking context. The banks have clearly invested heavily in terms of, you know, dollars and commitment from the organisation to put these sorts of frameworks in place. My perception has been that APRA haven't quite known what they've wanted through that process, and so as a result they've kind of picked and choose what they see as best practice. So the question is, in your view, what do you think APRA have perceived to be the top two or three most important components of a risk management framework?
That's an easy question. I think you're absolutely right that APRA haven't known exactly what they want. And I think, to be fair to them and everybody else in the world, particularly in op-risk, it's a new game. And you have to expect that there's going to be a fair amount of iteration between the regulators and the banks, or the entities that are being regulated. And I think philosophically, the regulators have had there's a really fundamental shift happening here in op-risk, not so much in other things. This fundamental shift is that the regulators are now moving into an environment where they allow the entities to build the models, and they don't specify what the models are. The regulator's job is not to reproduce the models anymore, but to give themselves enough comfort that the model's actually okay. That's a fundamental shift from the good old days when they said, here are your evaluation parameters, do the calculation, tell me the answer, right, and add 2% or whatever it is for solvency. So I think the regulators are struggling a little bit with that, about, you know, how to let go, in a sense. And I think, particularly with Basel II coming through in this space, the regulators of the world's got ears. I think the regulators have focused too much on the models, too much on the statistical theory, for want of a better word. They have not really come to grips with the fact that the data's crappy, right? And when you put garbage in, you get garbage out. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with. I think they have, in some sense, correctly tend to focus on levels of conservatism, which has caused a lot of banking people angst because they don't think that way. It's not good or bad, it's just different. That, I think, has been good but hard. And I think that by focusing on the models, which in some sense is the easy thing to focus on, they've not yet really come back and got sorted on the cultural side of it. So back to my triangular picture, they're on the bottom left corner. They probably look at the top bit, which is about policy and risk appetite, because that's in their general mantra of looking at governance. All right, so they've probably got those two bits sorted. But I suspect there's not enough focus yet on the allocation models and on the actual culture and behavioural things. So that'll be round two, I think. And having said that, I mean, there are plenty of, you know, there's lots of real genuine modelling issues out there. And you could probably half or double the numbers from any bank, to be frank, without trying very hard in a, you know, quote, reasonable numbers. So it's not to say it's not difficult. And perhaps a certain amount of proof sitting in the pudding, which is that we haven't had a bank failure in the country in the last little while, and they seem to be travelling along okay. It's not true in all other countries. So, you know, the level of conservatism APRA's put in, they've put in the mark of you can't have less than 90% of the standard measure, which is roughly where we were. You know, from a theoretical point of view, oh, that's terrible. From a pragmatic point of view, I'm surprised they didn't put in 95%, to be quite honest, because we all know that nobody knows the right answer so far. So there's iterations to go around on this.
Ross.
Is there a little green line on?
Yep, hello. having been involved with bank risk and more recently the new general insurance regime where operational risk was brought in, I think APRA was running ahead of itself here. You're talking about APRA. Obviously, you're talking more operational risk with the big banks. And one thing with the GI side of it, and we'll see, I guess, what happens with, you know, life insurance, that's the Solvency II thing, will sweep the world. But there's got to be, Basel done well to have the big carrot there to go internal models. So the big banks, as you say, are spending a fortune globally on researching operational risk. But what APRA did with general insurance was the carrot to go internal model wasn't big enough. Of course, the standard method, the prescribed basis, as they call it, is pitched obviously to not make it too hard for the smaller player, and hence the incentive to do work for operational risk by the big players was not really there. And in assisting one of these large insurers looking for a way through to, well, hey, APRA wanted these guys to use a DFA type model, that they wouldn't take the, although the regulation said you could do a partial approach where perhaps there's a standard method for operational and you can do your insurance and investment risk, catastrophe risk, modelled. But didn't want to play the game, but the cop-out they had was they said the prescribed method had implicit operational risk. You like that one. We haven't bothered, although we refer to the Basel standard saying, well, hey, they've got 20% now reduced to 10. Oh, I don't know what Basel 2 is at now for a standard method, but...
Check with the politicians.
Yeah, it was they'd taken the cop out, but they wouldn't let the big players. Well, you know, that was the way it was a couple of years back. You couldn't do the standard method because there wasn't one for operational.
Yeah, that was part of the problem.
No, you know, it was just more of a away from the banking area. Obviously, you're talking about big four banks, perhaps big five, whatever number we've got today.
Check anyway. I think one of the things that Basel II really did do was it put operational risk on the table for everybody, because they said you're going to hold explicit capital for it. And as soon as someone says you're going to hold capital for it, everybody's interested. Now, in that sense, from a sort of really broad political point of view, that got it on the map. And what's not happened yet, maybe barring Solvency II, which is sort of rolling its way through, but up until now, op risk hasn't got that same impetus behind it, because up until now, it could be implicit, which means, I'll think about it and I'll worry about it, but I'm comfortable where I am, and we haven't gone bust yet anyway, and we're not called HIH, so it's okay. That's being a bit flippant. I think the other observation I make is that if you look at Basel II for the operational risk part, which is not very long, you can read it, the thing that doesn't get enough airplay is all the preconditions that are sitting in there for being allowed to use the AMA methodology anyway. Now, and I'm talking about the non-modelling stuff. This is all about culture and behaviour and process reporting and all those. Absolutely generic. And I think the place to go for this sort of stuff, particularly when the scope for development, is actually to go down, back on my picture here if you like, not to go to the left-hand corner and build the models, to go to the right-hand corner and build the culture and the reporting process, because that gets your prevention stuff in place anyway. There will always be a way to build a model, okay? It just depends on how approximate it is. You're always going to have some judgment in on top of it, reasonableness checking and so on. So I think the thing that Basel II suggests to me for organisations who aren't forced to explicitly compute the capital is there's a whole raft of guidance sitting there about how you go about doing the prevention and the cultural stuff in your organisation. And that, at the end of the day, is what's going to make the difference. Building a model is nice and it puts some quantification around it, but not the key thing. And the other observation I make about models is there's an exercise here between consistency and correctness, and we tend to confuse the two. If I build a model, even if it's approximate, and it produces silly numbers, so I don't use them when I actually do my reporting, I can still use that model if I'm looking at trends from period to period, because what I'm then looking for is consistency and whether I'm getting better or worse. That tells me quite a lot from an internal point of view, even if I've got the wrong numbers coming out. So there's a role for models at a lower level than get the number that goes in the accounts, which is potentially equally as powerful. So there's a couple of sort of stepping stones sitting in there. I don't know if that helps, but that's, again, it comes back to what I said. I think the regulators, well, the regulators and the industry and the academics, everybody, has focused far too much on building the models as opposed to the culture that sits behind where the events will happen. That'll take a long time to come through.
Thanks once again, Jules. I see the bell has gone, or rather I hear the bell has gone. I see we've run out of time, so I'd like to close this session now. I can see people are very pensive because they're thinking about the next round of questions, but I guess that'll have to wait. So once again, can you thank Jules for his talk?